Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Well, hello there. Welcome to another episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I am your host, Emma Gunn Wardner, and in this episode, I'm joined by author, runner, open water swimmer, and all-round go-getter, Alexandra Hemingsley. Now, the first time I came across Alex was a few years ago when I was still very much caught in my running bug. And I would run 5, 6, sometimes 7 times a week. And, you know, they weren't little short stints. I was doing kind of an average of about 6 kilometres a day, you know, just felt right at the time. And I think I was on the cusp of running the Royal Parks half marathon for the children's charity Click Sergeant. And I read her book, Running Like a Girl, which made my desire to run really catch fire, even more than it was already. And what I loved about the book was that for me, it was the polar opposite of the narrative that's pushed by all the health and fitness magazines. And yes, yes, before you groan, I know I write for some of these titles. But yet I often find myself grimacing and cringing at the cover lines that promise a shred or a certain amount of fat loss in 2 weeks, even though I know the science of these things is that it's the promise of this that makes people, women, buy them in the first place. For me, though, as someone who is not a natural built athlete, I'm more Kardashian in physique than Radcliffe. It makes me feel as though I'm at the bottom of a slippery slope trying to scrabble to be someone that, when I use the sensible part of my brain, I know I can't ever physically be. I'm never going to have Meghan Markle's legs. Forget junk, there's a fair amount of chunk in my trunk, and I think I've come to terms with that. But that's not to say I can't be active and set myself physical goals. But it's this veiled promise of being the person who's staring out at me from the cover of the magazine that makes me buy expensive gym gear I can't really afford and attempt classes I'm not really physically capable of, because I feel as though if I have those two parts of the equation, then surely the result of long lean limbs and yoga toned arms will follow. Well, guess what? That's a nonsense. In Running Like a Girl, I really felt as though Alex was talking to me. It's realistic. It acknowledges that we can't be perfect all of the time, and that venturing out on the road to run or to the gym is as much a mental battle as it is a physical one. It's also the closest I've ever come to seeing a 1980s movie montage in print, because you see, feel and understand the challenges, the battles and the obstacles, and then you see, feel and understand her successes when, despite all of those things, she's achieved them. And I got it. Like, I really got it. Because I've never run on the road, in the gym, done a boot camp, a spin class, or a bums and tums without feeling like I didn't belong there. Like I was the runt of the litter who should be rewarded for having the gumption for just turning up. And god damn it felt good to know that I wasn't alone in this neighbourhood. Subsequently, I then started tweeting Alex to say how awesome the book was. And I told everyone I knew that they had to read it. And it put Alex very much on my radar as someone I really wanted to follow, because I found her output really valuable. I felt so happy that there was someone with this voice out there in the world who was basically speaking the truth. Running Like a Girl isn't by any means her only book, and in fact she writes regularly for many publications, and I'll put the links to some of her recent articles in the show notes on iTunes and emmaguns.com. I've actually just started reading her first book, X in the City, You're Nobody Till Somebody Dumps You, and I highly recommend it. Again, she articulates thoughts and feelings in a way that I can really get on board with, and it's just like she's pulled them out of my own brain and just made them sound a hell of a lot better in print. When we organised this recording, I wanted to talk to her about writing, about sharing not only her successes, but the obstacles she's faced, about her follow-up to Running Like a Girl, Leap In, which charts her journey to become a competent open water swimmer, as well as we touch on her experiences with IVF. Leap In, again, is starting from zero, if you like saying, right, I want to, in the same way she said, I want to run, it was, I want to swim. And it's charting the fact that it takes work. And she says something in this podcast, which I genuinely may get tattooed on me or just made into a big print, which is less permanent, but no less impactful, I think, of when she talks about achieving your goals, she says, a goal is 1,000 tiny decisions. And it's so right. It's that moment in the morning when your alarm goes off and you'd have a choice. You can hit snooze, get under the covers and get all nice and snuggly, or you can make that tiny decision to get up, have a coffee and get in your gym gear and go out. And it's a tiny decision. And it really resonated with me. And again, I genuinely might get that made into a print. I really hope you enjoy this. During the conversation, we both mentioned some articles and references. And of course, all of those links will be in the show notes. And you know this, if you're a regular listener, I love hearing from you. So why not drop me an email to thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. For now, though, here she is, the brilliant Alexandra Hemingsley on The Emma Gunn Show. Well, this is lovely, because when you've stalked somebody on social media and then you find themselves in your home, it feels equally inappropriate and wonderful. Alexandra Hemingsley, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I stalked you, and I use stalk as an exaggeration. I fangirled you, which sounds far less aggressive and punishable, on Twitter when I read Running Like a Girl about 4 or 5 years ago, because you 100% spoke to the girl that I've always been, which is not sporty, but quite determined what I want to be, and who wants to be a better version of myself.
Yes.
Do you want to just let the listeners know a little bit about running, what Running Like a Girl was about?
Well, it kind of came out of Twitter, because I had done one marathon in 2007, and then I moved to Brighton in 2010, and I was doing lots of running sort of 2-3 years following that. And I was loving it, and I'd kind of moved a bit single and miserable to the seaside, and running really helped me to get to know my city, and it changed my perspective on things and what I was capable of. And and it was early Twitter before, like,
pre-Instagram
the Nazis Twitter and stuff. Yeah. And it was really joyful, and I used to tweet little pictures of things that I'd seen because there was no Instagram, and it was a really kind of gleeful thing. And people, possibly even you, started to tweet me saying, you seem to really like running and you seem normal. What can I read about it? Because I was also reviewing books and writing a lot about books then too. And I would be like, I need to find something that in good conscience I can recommend to people, because the market was completely split down the middle then. So they were either quite masculine narrative non-fiction books, which were like, day 3 in the desert and 4 of my toenails had fallen off, but I persisted. And they were a bit like, oh, any of you wanted to sort of try 5K? Or they
just
were...
just get to the end of my street thing.
Yeah. Or they were pink and they were how running can help you get your bikini body.
Ugh.
And there was nothing in the middle that was just sort of, you might like goals that are not to do with how the world sees you, but to do with how you see the world. For women, they were very masculine and extreme, or they were to do with looks.
And very superficial,
And so it was quite weird, because I sort of I'd worked in publishing for like 12 years by this point, where I know what it's like when you, once you work in an industry which other people are interested in, you kind of get that thing when you go and see your mum and dad and people are like, so what can I do to, and I've been saying for 12 years, well, you just have to write what you know about and what no one else is writing about. And suddenly after blithely dispensing this information for years and years, the penny dropped and I realised that there was no one who was writing this. And I just changed agents because I was doing quite a lot of ghostwriting, and she'd agreed to be my agent for ghostwriting, and I had this sort of quite tense cup of coffee with her when I'd kind of written my pitch for Running Like a Girl to tell her, and I was like, I know we've only just signed this, but I really, really, really want to do this book. There's nothing like it. I know that it has to happen and that someone else is going to do it, if not me. So let me know if you want me to leave again. And she's and that was sort of the strength of my conviction that I really wanted to do the book. And instead of saying, yes, now leave, she said, no, stop the ghostwriting for a few months, do this. And so it felt quite kind of almost easy because it seemed so obvious because people were asking for this book that I was looking, like scrolling around the internet trying to find something to recommend people that they weren't finding, and I wasn't finding, so I wrote it.
and I think it was one of those books that I started reading it. Seem to remember it's one of the first books I read on a Kindle as well, so it was like double exciting. And it was, to say that I just consumed it in just one sitting is not an exaggeration. I really did. Again, I have written for magazines that I groan at their cover lines, but I guess always been quite susceptible to this idea of being once you get to your best version of yourself, you'll look like the girls on the front of those magazines.
Yeah.
And so I am a yo-yoer, and so when I used to get down to like a weight that I felt comfortable with, I would be massively disappointed that I didn't look like those girls on magazines, and then I would...
Or felt like how you felt they felt.
Yeah, and it was just the way that, I think, as you say, it was about how you feel about yourself and the goals that you set yourself.
Yeah, and what you see outwards, I saw so much more life by running. I experienced a greater emotional landscape and a physical landscape. I learnt to love Brighton and Hove by having to kind of
navigate,
add 3K to a run when I'd run out of seafront, and so I'd have to do a loop, and then I'd be like, oh, I think did I go for dinner here a couple of weeks ago? And then you don't normally always do that when you move somewhere, is sort of have to sort of traipse around it quite that much. And also just, there's something quite specific about marathons, I think, where people are often doing them as a result of grief or after substance abuse or all kinds of things where people have really, really pushed themselves beyond what they ever thought they could be, either emotionally or physically or both. And there's such a sort of public-spirited goodwill around them that I found that very heartening and reassuring. I was at kind of a bit of a lonely point in my mid-30s, and it really did teach me a lot about community and things like that that I had never anticipated running would do.
Did it also give you, was it also a motivator?
Yeah, because if you, I mean, it's so kind of intoxicating when you start running, because if you're doing a plan, it doesn't take that long before you do start to get a little bit better every time. And it is sort of just the maths of it, that if you do the right kind of training and you do get out and you don't tell yourself that you've got out, except you really haven't for 10 days, you do just get a little bit better every time, and you can add half a mile or a mile or a couple of miles on once a week, and you're on this kind of steady upwards trajectory. And then I sort of realised I can apply this to other things. I can be more than I thought I could be. If something as arbitrary as running, which I'd never really considered, and like you, I wasn't a sporty girl, if I can do this, then maybe I can stand up for myself a bit better when I've got to do my invoicing, or I can, you know, hold my own in this kind of conversation with someone who I might otherwise have been intimidated by or whatever. It just sort of made me feel maybe I could take up a little bit more space in the world than I had previously believed.
And that's really, really beautiful. I love that, because I do think it's about building your self-esteem, and it is about running is about measuring against yourself. It's like, what did I do yesterday? Can I do a little bit better today? Without getting too competitive. Or just even the very act of getting out of bed.
Yeah.
When do you run, by the way? Are you a morning runner?
I am usually, but I do, I like running after dark as well. I do quite like, especially on the seafront when it's quiet, because sometimes it can feel a bit performative running on the seafront here, especially in the summer and stuff. So sometimes I do like to go and do a bit of sprinting on the seafront when there's no one else around, so... But I genuinely, I would choose morning if I had infinite childcare and all the day.
Now, tell me about what it must have been like to write this book and then have people like me, strangers, say you've said the things that I had been thinking. Like, it must have been quite incredible to realise that you were articulating not just for yourself, but for a massive group of women who perhaps felt underrepresented.
It was the most gratifying thing in the world, partly because as a writer, sort of, and as a reader, like I've read since I was tiny, and it's that most magical moment ever when you're reading a book, and even if it was written like 200 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever, when there's sometimes you can love a whole book just for two lines, when you have that moment of just... I'm not alone. I'm not the only one that had that thought that I was either slightly embarrassed by or slightly taken aback by or whatever. And it's such a magic feeling, like you're kind of reaching across generations or ages or whatever and just sort of touching someone and going, oh, it wasn't just me. So the idea that I could do that to other people, it felt like, you know, I'd got an invisibility cloak or something comparably magical. It was just amazing. And also just so many people now, Running Like a Girl was published nearly 5 years ago, and so many people have run so many miles and raised so much money now, and the number of times people have sent me pictures of their medals and things like that. It's just like, in a really nerdy physics way, I love that level of actual energy of human beings. That's kind of the number of miles that have been done and people that have moved, and just the energy that's been put to positive things makes me so, 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 so happy.
Well, we were talking before we started recording about positivity breeds positivity. And so to have put out something that has had this massive ripple effect across the globe.
Yeah.
That, as you say, has led to people pounding on pavements, running marathons, setting goals that they weren't potentially... Perhaps potentially didn't think they could achieve. That must...
It's lovely, and I do try really hard on social media not to just put up pictures of things that have pissed me off or complain about things I've heard on the radio or whatever. I try really hard to... Because it's so nice when you just have got 2 seconds in a shop queue and you look at your phone and if something just makes you smile, it's so much better for you than if you look at something and you're like, what? Someone said what? And you might never, that whole fuss, you know, a politician might have said something for 5 minutes, and sometimes if you don't look at your phone for 4 hours, the whole thing's died away again and it seems silly.
Exactly.
But if you get in that moment, it's... You know, it can just raise your blood pressure for a day.
Yeah, it's rants, and it's also that feeling when, and then someone puts up something a bit bland, like, or that feeling when your computer doesn't start or something.
Like, I don't mind that. My day would have been fine without it, but then when someone's just put something smiley or silly, then it does... make me smile.
Now, I'm not wanting to project my own running life onto you, but I do want to ask you, so when I was running, I would motivate myself because I'm very much somebody who responds to outer expectations. I've just done a podcast with Gretchen Rubin.
I love her. I went to see her talk.
Oh, at the Red Thing?
No, at the other one, the not School of Life. What was it? The Academy of Ideas?
Oh,
is that what it's called?
Four attendances. I'm an obliger, so...
I'm a questioner.
Are you now?
Yes.
Oh, well, that would explain why you wrote that book.
Yeah, because I went with my agent, who is an obliger.
Okay.
mercifully for me. And we both spent the whole thing kind of slyly half looking at each other and pointing and smiling at each other whenever she was talking about whichever one we were. But I realised that I was totally a questioner, because in a way that was how... I didn't write Running Like a Girl until I knew that it was wanted.
Yes.
It was like, I was able to say with confidence, I know that this book, there are people that who would read it. Whereas previously, all the other books I tried to write, I just had sort of collapsed under the weight of me sitting there going, but why? Why would someone want to read it? Why?
We are going to come back to that, but I just want to ask you, so with my running, I was connected to an app, and yes. The thing that would get me out of bed was I would go and do my run, and at one point I was running like 8K every morning.
Wow.
And yeah. I'm an all or nothing kind of a girl. Mm. Between 7 and 8K, and then I'd get in, and I'd be like so keen to get on my Wi-Fi so that I could share it on Twitter. And every time I then go out to a work thing, people would be like, oh, have you already done your run this morning?
Yeah.
And it was sort of twofold. First of all, it got me out of bed.
Yeah.
But also it kept me doing it the next morning.
Yeah.
Because I was like, people are going to respond and people are going to think that I'm a runner, and that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
But then I think the inevitable happens with every runner's life is you sort of stop,
plateau,
slow down.
Yeah.
Or yeah, like if you, I think once I did a half marathon, I didn't know, well, what next?
Well, it's difficult because there's a sort of perception that I got that for like years. Mm. What next? So you're going to do an ultra marathon? So you're going to do like an only uphill marathon? Or how are you going to whittle your time down even further? And it seemed like, well, that's such a narrow view of what you're getting out of running. If all that you're getting out of it is like numbers. I mean, I'm not super big on numbers anyway. But it was the spectrum of a run can be like, it's continuing to change my mood, or it's continuing to allow me to, you know, take the tube home and read rather than feel I had to walk home, or things like that. There are so many different reasons that aren't quantifiable by an app. One of the reasons I started getting more into swimming was because I was so bored of this idea that you either had to go further or be faster.
Yeah.
That an app, it's like, an app doesn't know how to say, oh, didn't the sky look lovely today? Because it doesn't know. And I was like, come on, app.
Yeah.
Know my moods better.
Yeah, that's so
and
true.
And it was like, I found myself completely cramped by just the numbers.
Mm.
And so swimming was lovely for that, because you could do the same swim and it will be way more different every day according to the weather. Than, I mean, a run is a bit more different according to the weather, but swims were much more. But now I've kind of returned to running more calm about.
Yeah, because it is one of those, I feel like it is one of those pursuits that you can become ultra competitive with yourself. And it's like, well, I'll just go down that side street, and I know I'll add like another 500 metres onto my run.
Yeah. The Gretchen Rubin thing's really interesting, because I hadn't, what was it? It's obligers,
questioners and rebels.
Yeah, and the upholders, or was it the obligers? So one of them, I was interested that they will only go for a run if they're in a club or going with someone, because it's not the idea of letting themselves down that could be motivating, but the idea of letting another person down.
Yeah.
I'm totally not like that. For me, running has to be the feeling of, I'm just going to dart out the door, I'm going to do it right now, or fitting it in around other stuff to do with me. I'd feel horrendous pressure if it was always tethered to someone else. I'd be like, oh my God, I'm so slow. Do you really want to run with me? And things like that.
So. Me too, but I do like being tethered to them via an app so that I can go, did it!
Yeah.
Which is weak.
I mean, when I started running, it was 2007, and it was before everyone had iPhones. And to find out how far a route was, I had this thing that was like a pen, which instead of a nib had a tiny, tiny wheel on the end. And you'd go on an A to Z or a map, and you'd wheel the pen. So it was like a pizza slice on the end, but a tiny, tiny...
Oh, there's a Mac eyeliner, actually, that has adopted the exact same technology.
Oh, yeah, I can see that would work, yeah. And that was how you would do it to see. So if you needed to do a 12-mile run, you'd have to open up a map wide and go all the streets you were planning to do. And then you'd have to kind of keep wiggling to see if you got to 12 miles yet. And then come home. And I did all my first runs with just like street names all around South, Northwest London, all written up my arm. And there was, and I still did it. I wanted to do it enough, but it was quite lonely, and also I imagine possibly quite inaccurate at times. So yeah, there's no kidding an app, that's for sure.
No, there's no kidding an app. I am curious what you think about
women's magazines, particularly the ones that focus on health and fitness, and the messaging that they push out there, because I feel very conflicted by it.
Yeah.
Because I get sucked in, but then I hate myself for getting sucked in.
My pet hate with these magazines, which has come out of since running Like a Girl, where they've commissioned me to do pieces, is the sort of bad science when a spurious, I don't know, like a kind of brand of coconut oil or something yeah. has commissioned some research and it was done on like 40 people and was with a highly leading question or whatever. And then the women's magazine will manage to get a 900 word feature out of this piece of research that is sort of telling you that something is a trend or something is how we should all be living. And that kind of misleading science in health and fitness publications, I think is really, it's if not dangerous, then just slightly unhealthy. Whereas I've just become quite kind of highly strong about really going, like clicking the link back to see what the actual research was.
Right.
So often it's like, you know, we should all be eating more chocolate because it turns out you have better sex after you've eaten chocolate. And it's like, hold on, this massive multinational just commissioned this chocolate research and it was 30 people in Stoke that were given some free chocolate. Of course they were happy when you asked them about their sex lives. They were on a massive sugar high and that kind of thing. But I do think there's a sort of unique relationship that women have with their bodies, that discussion about exercise and health and stuff. I like that there's a market that's specific, but I don't always agree with how that market is behaving. And I find the cover lines, I mean, I can sometimes have to like pull my hat down when I walk past magazine stands just because of some of the implication that still, even after all this time, everything should be to do with being lean. And it's, oh yeah.
Well, there's a preferred body type, and if you don't, and that body type is sort of long, lean, and quite boyish in girls. Like if you look at covers, it's always, you know, you rarely see a very small waist. And then it's sort of, I just think it's all quite muddy. I find it irresponsible. But I know, having worked in the magazine industry, I've been really susceptible to it.
Yeah.
And I've gone on shoots, so many shoots, with celebrities, people who've been on the covers of magazines. And I see them in the flesh. And they are the sort of person that if you worked with them in an office in, you know, doing an admin role, they would be your skinny friend.
Yeah.
They are smaller than average humans who look very good on camera.
Yeah.
Fact.
And there's sort of the argument always given is as well that these are the things that sell. And that's because people buy what they're comfortable with. I buy the same brand of, I don't know, bread or whatever when I'm doing online supermarket shopping because it's the one that I got last time. I don't go every time and go, ooh, what's the best new bread out there today? I go with what I'm familiar with, and that's, you know, you're not always going to pick up the magazine that looks a bit weird and different. If it's in a supermarket magazine stand, obviously you are if you've gone to your specialist magazine shop for all those kind of magazines that cost £20. Yeah, I find it very, very conflicting. But it's just the endless perpetuation of the idea that exercise has one function only.
Yeah. And also, I feel like 1 week or 1 month you read a magazine and it's eat avocados, eat as many as you like. It's so great for you. And the next month it's like avocados are bad, be paleo. And and I feel like there's just so much confusing messaging out there. And actually, calories in, calories out. Cardiovascular exercise, a bit of strength exercise, that's the magic formula, maybe.
Yeah, but also your how much weight you lose is going to be far more significantly tethered to your diet than your exercise. Exercise will only ever help your cardiovascular system and your strength and your psychological well-being. It's not ever going to do that much to for weight loss if you go for a 5k run every day and you still eat 2,500 calories, which are mostly carbs. You're never going to lose any weight, but you're consistently going to be more healthy as a fully rounded human being if you're exercising and doing that than if you're just in pursuit of extreme leanness and to the point of being unhappy.
Yes, I agree. Now, we talked about it a minute ago, the book that you wrote before Running Like a Girl.
Yes.
Now, this was a book about heartbreak.
Lesson learnt. This was the this was the thing that taught me more than anything else about putting positivity out there, because I wanted to write a book about heartbreak. Specifically, I wanted to reframe the idea of being dumped as not being always a negative thing, mm-hmm. that it's a sort of, you're a positive person, you're still trying, you're not just a sort of doormat, mm-hmm. if you don't end the relationship, you're just usually the more optimistic of the two, or the more hopeful, right, or whatever. Because I realised that, you know, I'd got to 30 and I'd had all these relationships end, and on the whole, it hadn't been me that had ended them, except sometimes it had because of my behaviour. It was just that I was never the one that would say it. Mm. But because I was much younger and I hadn't had any, I hadn't really done any journalism at this point either, I hadn't had an experience of what it felt like when a large number of people have read your work. And so I wrote this book and really laid it out there. And I kind of was almost unfiltered. anything for a laugh, basically. I should have just called the book, Like Me! And it was 10 years ago. It was the summer my sister got married. And it was brilliant. Like, my publisher was so, it's going to be in all the airports. So when we got to, my sister got married in Italy. So when we got there, everyone there had read or got a copy of the book. And so my sister's younger than me, and she had this amazing kind of beautiful Italian hilltop village wedding.
Oh, wow.
And I was the older sister who'd written a book about being dumped. And I didn't understand that if you write a book that's funny about things that were very painful, you've licensed everyone to laugh at it. So for the whole week we were in Italy, everyone was like, oh yeah, that guy, oh my God, that must have been a nightmare. And people would like suddenly walk up from their sun lounger and be like, oh my God, I can't believe you said that. And I just thought, can you all just shut up about it? But I couldn't say that because I'd written it and gone quite far out of my way to get someone to publish it and publicise it and all of that stuff. So when it did really well for a summer and then didn't kind of have the longevity that Running Like a Girl has turned out to have. So when I wrote Running Like a Girl, I was way more filtered about what I was prepared to have people have opinions about on me.
See, now this is really interesting because I really strongly believe that your failures are oftentimes more important than your successes.
Yeah.
Not that I'm suggesting that your first book was a failure, but as you said, it informed the way that you wrote in a way that produced a very successful book.
And it was a dead end. It wasn't ever going to... There wasn't really anything I could say once I'd written it because it was completely passive. It was about an experience I'd had that was sort of dependent on other people, whereas the running was like, I got up, I did it, I decided to do it. And it just completely flipped how I saw things about making stuff happen for oneself.
There's quite an interesting symmetry between the notion of the book, being dumped is not a bad thing, and the effect that it had on your life in the sense that you're able to write Running Like a Girl.
It's
not a bad thing that the book had a great summer and then...
No, and it completely informed how I wanted my voice to feel in Running Like a Girl, in terms of sort of just a sense of agency and ownership over one's own actions. That was how I wanted my voice to sound, it was how I wanted my life to be, and it was how running was enabling me to be at the time. But I don't think I would have felt as much conviction about those things if I hadn't had the experience of sort of writing Ex and City about things that had happened to me, and then the experience of being published sort of happened at me. And I felt a bit like, how do I get control over this again, guys? And the answer was to just talk a bit less about it and do a bit less.
Yeah. You are somewhat of an open book. Do you filter yourself now, or do you...
I try not to... a friend once said to me, don't write breaking news, which I think is a really good rule of thumb. I would be a terrible, terrible blogger because I think I do write... I am quite an open book and I do write quite kind of raw stuff, but I have to leave a gap because I think otherwise it would be too sort of sad, maybe, or sad without context, or it would be I don't know, reveal too, nobody needs every single detail of every single thing that happens. Mm. Like, there's a lot, when I wrote about IVF, I didn't write that much about the specifics of the process, because it's really easy to Google that. Mm. What was important to readers was how it made me feel and how it would make them feel. You can just go on YouTube and find out about how to do the injections.
Yeah, you said something really interesting about the fact that, and I found it quite beautiful as someone who has had hormone issues, which are completely different but similar in the sense of, there have been times in my life when I've had to say, am I really upset? Am I really going through a depressive period? Mm. Or is this that my hormones are playing up again?
Yeah. Or is it natural to have ebb and flow in our emotions? There's someone's writing a book about this at the moment. It's going to be brilliant. It's called Hormonal.
Oh.
Eleanor Morgan, who wrote a book about anxiety.
Yes.
She's
Ellie Morgan.
Yeah. She's completely brilliant. And she's writing about that sort of interchange between hormones malfunctioning, completely natural emotions, and depression, and how completely sort of animalistic it can be, and how much is just natural. And we shouldn't all be reading magazines all the time and trying to achieve happiness as if it's this one constant state that we will achieve and then be sort of left living in. And I think it's going to be really, really fascinating, because I loved what she wrote about anxiety.
As we're talking about IVF, we should say that if you
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Keep hearing us chuckle a bit, it's because we are watching through patio doors Linus, your lovely little baby boy, playing with MK.
Playing with MK indeed.
Making very cute faces, I should hasten to add. But the thing that you said was about when you were injecting yourself with hormones and you were obviously flooded with an intense, which causes a big physiological change. It was that thing of, are these feelings real? Or are they just the hormones? And then if they are just the hormones, how do I then process that and be
Yeah.
That was really interesting.
Yeah, it was. And it was sort of interesting to go through. Because the first round of IVF I did, I was really, really open about. Because I thought that you'd take like 2 or 3 injections and then you'd just go crazy, like Grace Poole in Jane Eyre, like rampaging. So I sort of went, I had anticipated this insane forthcoming behaviour. And so I told Luke, oh, I'm going to do IVF, so you know, if I say anything really weird at dinner next week, it's because of the injections. And it isn't like that. It's not as cut and dried as that. It's like you're just going behind more and more layers of perspex, a bit further away from feeling like yourself. It's not like you just lose your mind. And I really regretted it, because then what happened was I had 9 million people saying, how's the IVF going? Any news? Which was awful, because all the news was bad then for a few months. And so when I did the second lot, we didn't tell anyone at all. And it was so much easier. And I'm not one for secrets, but just sort of being a bit private for a while was much easier to manage in terms of...
Well, I guess as well, if you are good at talking about something in a way that is relatable...
Yeah,
it's a muscle. Like, it must actually be harder not to than to.
Yeah, and I know that being a questioner, I could tell that all our appointments at the clinic were taking twice as long as everyone else's, because every single thing I was like, oh, so what do most people do? Does that look? Was that what everyone's ovary looks like? And ooh, what's that machine do? Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh my god.
Did you look for people with a voice that you wanted, like, I want to read about their experience? Did you find comfort
in that? No, I tried really hard not to, because I think with things like that, you can find whatever you're looking for.
Yeah.
So And there's masses of sort of online communities, and there's a whole strange language around IVF and pregnancy of like little angels and all of these sorts of euphemisms for embryos that don't make it or babies that haven't been born yet and all that kind of thing. And I found it quite overwhelming. If you just kind of Google what does IVF feel like or something, you will immediately get to some forums which sincerely do look like all the women have lost their minds. And I don't doubt that those women were in a difficult place when they went online and that perhaps, you know, lots of them are like 7 years old and they didn't know that this stuff was just going to sit there for years and years. Yeah. And their most vulnerable moments would be read by someone as judgmental as me 7 years later or whatever. But you do kind of log on and go, oh, blimey, what are you all on about? So I tried really hard, because you will just end up in a health food store with a giant bucket of bee pollen and because everyone wants to promise everything. And I was really lucky. I was treated really, really well by the clinic, and they were very pragmatic people. Because I think as it becomes more and more of an industry, it's more and more makes me anxious. The money making thing, egg harvesting and all of that in young people.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Celebrities talking about their egg harvesting as well, I feel like. Another thing that we're going to get girls to do, really?
I find it exceptional that it's easier for a 25-year-old to have what is an extraordinarily invasive process. When people talk about IVF, what they're really talking about is collecting the eggs. That's the difficult bit, it's the painful bit, that's the needles, that's the operation. The IVF happens while you're out cold. That's just someone in a lab. I mean, I'm sure they're very clever. And having it put in afterwards, it's like, that's like a smear test. It's nothing. It's really 2 minutes. The idea that that is easier than a few big companies sorting out their approach to working mothers or their child on-site childcare facilities at Apple. Surely it is cheaper to get some really kick-ass creches going in Silicon Valley than it is to have egg harvesting. I just can't believe that that is the easier... It's the easier option because it's largely men running those companies and... they don't have to do it. It's the same as I read an amazing article, I think it was on Broadly about a year or so ago, about how when they were inventing the pill, they had originally come up with one for men at the same time. But they canned it because it had side effects. It sometimes made some of the men a bit nauseous and a bit moody. Some of the men gained weight. And it's like, that's what the women's pill does, but you still put that one on the market.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day, thinking about the genesis of the pill. I don't know why. I think I'd read an article like you, but I was thinking, wait a minute, the pill would have been invented by men.
Yeah. Who actively chose to not pursue their research into the male pill because of the side effects.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah, that it seems inescapable to me that that's what's happening with the whole... Because it's those big blue chip companies that are really driving that market. Mm. The idea of like, come on, Google will get the best out of you this decade. You can think about children later because we've saved them for you in a lab. It's like, well, can't I just have my children when I want to? And then you can build a company that understands that mothers have children.
Also, I feel, and this is, we're recording this towards the very end of 40 Days of 40. And 40 Days of 40 has made me realise a lot. But one of the things is that all of the ambitions that I had at 25, so good childbearing years, good egg years.
Yeah, yeah.
Like maybe that 10 years between 25 and 35, I thought, yeah, I should be doing this. I should be editing a magazine, or I should be doing that cover interview, or I should be writing a book. Like I put all this pressure on myself to do stuff. And then... wasn't doing it, so then would put a lot of pressure on myself of being a failure. It's doing this 40 Days of 40 thing that's weirdly made me realise I wasn't ready then. I didn't have the skills or any of the stuff to do it. Like now I could reasonably go to a publisher and say, I have a book that I would like to write, and all of those things that I could breeze into because I spent those years learning. So the idea that you would put off, let's harvest your eggs so that we can use you then, I feel a little bit like, but you might not get the best out of people in those 10 years necessarily.
Yeah, but also, I would like to have thought that, you know, all those things that you want to do when you're 28, we thought that those were the things we wanted to do then, because we were receiving very strong messages from the world that the choice was one or the other.
Yes.
I never thought when I was approaching 30 and thinking about writing my first book, oh, I really want to do this and have a baby. And there was I had no template. All I ever read was pieces about how hard it was to have it all. Mm-hmm. I never read pieces about, well, you muddle through, it'll be fine. If you feel like, if you want to have a baby now and edit a magazine, it's doable. Mm. All I ever saw was, oh, the working mother's lot.
How hard it is. Also, if you did have a child and you were editing in a magazine, then you were probably quite steely in a little bit.
Yeah, because there was no template and it was a completely inflexible environment built around men's working days, which, let's face it, had a woman at the end of them putting the child to bed. Mm. And, you know, I really, much as I feel anxiety about some of the things about women's magazines, a lot of them have been run over the last 20 or 30 years by women who've really fought and kicked back to make them a better place for mothers to work in.
Yeah.
So
I make a note about Ellie and her book Hormonal. Do you know when it's out by any chance?
It's literally just been announced, so it won't probably be till at least next year.
Okay, exciting. I've actually been in touch with her to talk about anxiety on this very podcast.
Yeah, no, she's a very wise lady. Because she wrote her book on anxiety and then went away and studied, and she's now properly being qualified at the Homerton Hospital and is properly... She's not just a journalist with the power of Google anymore. She's studied stuff.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I love that. I've had Jo McGarry. Do you know Jo McGarry?
He was at Stylist Magazine. Yeah.
She, beauty director, and now is in a full-time university course in Chinese medicine and acupuncture.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. It's interesting that people have gone from that, from working in magazine environments, because I do think there's a little bit of a waftiness about the surveys and things that get turned into giant features and trends.
Yes. Isn't there just? Well, you have to fill pages, don't you? So
yeah.
You have to make a story. You have written another book called Leap In.
Yes.
Which is, there is symmetry with Running Like a Girl in the sense of it's your journey to becoming, you're now a very good, what do they call it, open water swimmer?
Well, I wouldn't say very good, very enthusiastic.
Capable?
Yeah, capable. I don't, like with my running, I don't go especially fast, but I can go for a while.
I love what you said. I read something you said, there's a real democracy about swimming.
Yes. It is the only sport in the world where women hold world records for the same events as more than men. Mm. So the female shape and where body fat is positioned on us is extremely compatible with open water swimming.
We're like seals, aren't we, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
But it's amazing. Like, distance open water swimming is something that women are just better at than men, which is really interesting when there's all this stuff raging about, you know, women in football and should women be paid the same, like that Billie Jean King film that just came out about women earning the same for the same sports and all that kind of thing. It's not just a steadfast rule, but
no, I feel like all of that, hopefully in our lifetime all of that will change and it will be equal.
Yeah Well, and also gender is getting more and more elastic as well.
That's true.
Very interesting to see how that all...
So what was the... you were not the poster girl for running, but you were obviously known
for... type of running, yeah. And everyone for a couple of years was like, so what are you going to do next? You know, what's your next running going to be? And I started writing a book that I thought was going to be wonderful about boxing and ballet. I was doing Muay Thai boxing.
Oh, yes.
And I was having ballet lessons at the Royal School of Ballet. And I was sort of looking at how similar the two were. Like, one's hyper-feminine, one's hyper-masculine, but actually, as far as skill sets go, they're very, very similar to do with the sort of nimble, small, tiny, fast muscle fibre things. And I thought it was going to be really interesting, and it was terrible, because I just didn't care enough about doing either of them.
Right.
Ballet is inescapably performative. Mm-hmm. So no matter how dynamic you have to be, or how powerful, or how beautifully aligned, you're always going to be doing it for someone else. Mm. It is only for being looked at. And boxing, it's just for hurting people. Like, that you can build tens of thousands of metaphors around life in the boxing ring and all the different kinds of boxing and blah, 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 blah. But it's fighting. Mm. And both of those things, I kind of couldn't... There was no point where I was learning more about myself there.
Right, we had a little interlude there, but we're back. And we're going to pick up exactly where we left off, which was talking about the book that you were going to write.
Yeah, so...
About boxing and ballet.
I was busy writing my boxing and ballet book, which I thought was going to be so insightful and wonderful. And meanwhile, I was learning to swim because I had really realised that after all this running up and down the seafront, I'd never really got into the sea and I was sort of falling in love with the idea of it. And it was about 6 months of swimming lessons before I realised that the thing that was really making me feel passionate about sport again after all of this sort of the aforementioned quantifiable running pressure was swimming. And I sort of realised that that was the book that I wanted to write. And when I actually spoke to my editor about it and sort of was commissioned to write the book, I didn't really know how it was going to end. I think I was going to do a lot more escapades and go off and do long swims and in exciting places and at exciting times or whatever. And then what actually happened was I started having the IVF and the narrative became much more to do with just keeping going. And so it became more about cold water swimming and swimming year round in the sea. And again, that thing, that idea of just expecting a tiny bit more of yourself, just do a little bit more today, do a little bit more today. And then before you know it, it's March and you did do all winter. And that was what the story became, not, you know, then she swam up the Ganges or whatever.
Do you think that running and swimming, had you started IVF without having done either of those things, do you think the process would have been different? Do you think that having the muscle memory of having started something as completely inexperienced and then getting very good helped you navigate that journey?
Well, I mean, I would hesitate to use very good. I'd say experienced. I had a lot of, self-knowledge about my body. In one sense, it helped me because I always had this sort of solace through the IVF and through pregnancy and having a tiny baby and everything. I knew that having been so rubbish at both of them to begin with, that I would be I knew that I wasn't scared of going back to being at rock bottom and having to work up again. So that was, there was a solace in that. I didn't have a kind of panic, like if, you know, I'd always been elite, I would have been like, oh my God, my whole career, my whole career. Whereas I didn't mind being average all over again. But the negative side of it was that because I had quite a lot of self-awareness about my body and I was getting huge amounts of solace from what I could do with it and, you know, kind of positively exhausting myself, that then when I felt the exhaustion of drugs or pregnancy or whatever, it felt like I'd really lost something of myself when I couldn't run anymore. I really, really missed it and longed for it. And this summer, because I ended up having a C-section, so obviously they, I don't know, I somehow naively hadn't realised that with a C-section they do, to get to the baby, have to cut through all your core muscles. And that's basically, with swimming, it's like your rudder, your core is how you twist and turn and navigate and all of those things. So I got into the sea the minute the doctor said I could again. And I had massively underestimated how terrifying that would be to basically be totally out of control. And so I really missed that this summer, to have a beautiful summer and to live on the seafront and to not feel quite able to get in the sea. So yeah, there were positives and negatives. It helped, but it made me more aware of what I didn't have when I didn't have it.
And are you back into running now? You just put up a post about...
Yeah, I'm just getting back into it. I'm really excited, actually, because for so long, people have been like, so are you running? What are you doing? What are you doing? And to have a goal again. And also, I love talking to people about it. I love it. It's a personal pleasure to persuade someone when they send me a nervous message or whatever. And also, I need the people to keep me going this time. I've set myself the goal of doing the Berlin Half Marathon in April. And I specifically chose that because I wanted to be on that trajectory at the same time as all the people doing the London and Brighton Marathon. And this is the hardest time of year because you could quite easily miss out on 2.5 weeks of training and just enjoy yourself over Christmas. And nobody wants to be one of those guys that goes for the Christmas morning run. like, oh, well done, everyone. Yeah, nice Instagram. but also it helps, you know. Christmas can get to you after a while, like day four of eating brown food
and being inside,
yeah, talking to people that you usually see a couple of times a year or whatever. And so I really wanted to be on the path then, and I want to do a big swim at the end of the summer so I can train over the summer. And so, yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's like being allowed to go back into my favourite room in the house for a while, after a while.
Do you, because I read this, and when I spoke to you about it briefly beforehand, you were like, oh, but I read that you set goals for yourself every year.
I don't think I realised that I was. Mm-hmm. But I definitely the last 10 years, like since I started running, and I think I'd underestimated, I hadn't dared to set myself goals when I was younger. I had this idea that I was just being tossed around life by life. And then it took me a while to take ownership and to appreciate how much of my own input was either effective or indeed required to reach goals. So once I kind of got the balls to set some goals, I do like it. I like having a think about what I want to achieve.
If someone's listening to this and they're thinking, I feel like I might be a better version of myself, or I want to be that person that sets a goal and sticks to it, do you have like a handbook list kind of style of advice that you would give them?
Well, the single most important thing is that no one is going to set that goal for you. Once you've, I don't know, done your A-levels, people, or unless you have a very hands-on boss who really wants to guide you through whatever your chosen career is, people are more interested in themselves, ultimately. And I think I was waiting for some sort of kindly benefactor type, like mentor type figure to be guiding me more than anyone was ever going to, realistically. And it's up to you. And as I learned with X in the City, sometimes the goals that don't fire off the way that you hope are as valuable as the ones that are an enormous success. And it was incredibly freeing and empowering to realise with running that I was allowed to set the goal and I was allowed to aim that high. I was allowed to go for it. Whereas before it'd been like, oh no, it'd be so cringe. What happens if I don't make it? Or, God, this is so mortifying. Everyone's going to think I'm so sort of full of it that I'm aiming for this. No one was ever that interested in me overshooting my expectations for myself. And so it's up to you. You're allowed to just set yourself any goal, and you're allowed to just try. That all you're ever doing is trying, as long as you're not, you know, stealing someone else's thunder along the way. It's up to you. And I don't think I'd ever truly appreciated that until properly like signing up for big marathons and receiving the training plan and realizing the goal seems so wildly unrealistic when you can barely run 5K. 26 miles is just laughable. But it's only ever 6 months worth of tiny chunks of 1 mile more. It's never just, oh, wake up and run 26 miles. It's committing to months of, I don't feel like it today, followed by, no, but it will be worth it. It's 1,000 tiny decisions. You never have to go, okay, today I'm doing my goal. You just have to decide every day to try and nudge a tiny bit closer.
I love that. I might get that tattooed somewhere. It's 1,000 tiny decisions.
It is. You never kind of go like, oh, really, like, you know, my HIIT session today was so powerful. I'm going to be able to do 12 miles more than last week. It's just the cumulative effect of every Wednesday evening when you wanted to watch Coronation Street, but you said, I'll just do my sprints for 20 minutes. And that it's only over 20 minutes.
It's only over 20 minutes, it's true. I'm getting back into running.
Yay!
Again. Excuse me.
Have you got my newsletter?
No, I'm signing up immediately.
I've just started a newsletter for my half marathon and my swimming training over the next year.
Right.
Because I just feel like I've got to drag everyone with me.
Yes. Well, I want the newsletter, but then we can text.
Yeah, obviously.
But I made massive change. I'm just interested what you think about this. Because I am definitely somebody who responds to morning exercise. Yes. I'm more alert in the morning and once I'm up. And I had a DNA test actually recently that confirmed this. And it was a DNA test that looked at health, hormones, diet and exercise. And it said endurance is my thing. endurance is what my body really likes. And it also said I was a morning person, and it said I metabolize caffeine really well, which means I'm the sort of person who can get up, shuffle to the coffee machine, make myself an espresso, neck it, and then within 5 minutes I'm like good to go.
Yeah, you should train fasted, as Joe Wicks would say.
Yep, so I have my espresso at 5:30 and I go for my run. I go inside at the moment because of the terrain and the trek in the darkness and all that kind of stuff. And I am running again.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, in order to do that, I'm going to bed at 10 o'clock every evening.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing is, once you start exercising more, you instinctively eat better because your body is going, can I have a bit of this, please?
Mm.
Instead of, you know, it's like, you know, when you're really skint and you just want to buy something to cheer yourself up, and you buy something that costs 20 quid, like the world's crappiest t-shirt or something.
Yeah.
Just to give yourself that little hit.
Mm.
And it's the same as if you're not exercising, eating badly feels like, well, I mean, in for a penny, kind of like, you know, my credit card bill is so huge, I may as well buy this kind of feeling. Whereas once you start exercising, you do start to feel, oh my God, I need to be drinking 2 litres of water a day. Give me my 2 litres.
Mm. And give me my rest.
Yeah. And rest is actually kind of, it sounds, I don't know if this is a term that's applicable. It feels like active rest rather than just indolence.
Yes. Yes.
There's, I mean, to the outside viewer, you are just the person lying on the sofa in both instances. Mm. But there's a difference between I've done it and now I rest and lying on the sofa going, oh, I still haven't done it.
But I found that I am someone who can easily become a night owl. And so I read a piece by Rosie Green in Red Magazine. It was about, if you want to be a morning person, it starts at 10 o'clock the night before when you go to bed.
Definitely.
And it took a week and a half before I was waking up naturally with my alarm at 5:30.
Yeah.
And it's that quick.
Yeah. It's astonishing how quickly it is to form habits. A really good book about that is First Bite by Bea Wilson, which is about eating habits.
Did she write that incredible piece this year about the food industry?
Yeah.
I'll put a link to that.
That was a natural extension of First Bite, which is about how malleable humans are in a positive and a negative. So it's really easy to form bad habits, but it is equally easy to form good habits, and also to persuade yourself that you like things that you thought were disgusting. And it starts with amazing pieces of research about how Japan used to eat incredibly unhealthily as a nation, but after World War II decided, like it was a governmental decision, to eat more healthily. And there's astonishing research about what children will do instinctively, and it's the single most powerful book about food, eating, diet, anything I've read in the last 2 years.
Buying it on the app as soon as we finish
recording. It's really, because it's really, really interesting about food, and it was what I read instead of any baby weaning books with my baby, was because there's a whole chunk about children's habits. But because it's extremely sort of forensic about the idea of habits being formed, it's sort of applicable to exercise as well. It might not have all the research, but I found it very easy to sort of look at larger habits because of realizing how highly persuadable we all are.
Highly persuadable. To end, I wanted to talk about the different elements. There was a brilliant interview you did where you talked about, you've got your water element, you've got the air, and you've got the earth, which is your running.
Yes.
What was the air one again? I've forgotten.
I don't know.
There was an air element. Did you do
what
something?
What was the interview?
It was the podcast you did.
Oh.
But, and then the suggestion was that fire might be motherhood. And those are your four elements.
Yeah.
And about whether you would write about motherhood. Is that something that's on the horizon?
I don't know if I would write about motherhood. Partly because I don't know enough about it. And also I don't want to make Linus be like a character.
Right, yeah.
But I definitely want to write about the experience of pregnancy and birth and post, the physical and emotional side of it. Mm. Aside from actually going and then looking after a baby, but the sort of what it does to your body and how you feel about yourself. Like, I mean, obviously watch quite a lot of In the Night Garden now. And I remember a few months ago when I was still not able to run or properly try and lose weight, I was still breastfeeding, and I remember looking at those characters and thinking that I feel like I'm wearing one of those outfits, like this big sort of Teletubby.
I have to admit, I haven't watched In the Night Garden, but I can imagine.
Just like a Teletubby outfit. And right. I felt like I've been wearing one of those for about 2 years now. Mm-hmm. And that there's something so extraordinary about the sort of massive overshare about some elements of pregnancy and post-birth, and massive undershare about others. And I also think that we are, as a nation, extremely badly served by postnatal care. And I want to write about that and what we need to be doing, because the French are extraordinarily good at it. Yes. And I'm really interested in their model and how we can use that to best serve ourselves. So, yeah, that idea of taking back ownership after being squatted in for a while. I don't know. I found it... I was expecting that pregnancy for me would be really empowering. I thought I would, especially after such a long wait, I thought I'd spend more time swanning around feeling like I am life, I am the giver of life, and actually
I am Mother Earth.
Yeah, I just felt like, seriously, when do I get my body back? I really felt like, I remember just saying at one point, I really cannot believe that Alien was not written by a pregnant woman. Just even if the screenwriter was a man, I think it was, I looked it up. I'm pretty sure his wife wrote it when he was asleep.
He
took credit, because it's such a, that feeling of being invaded was so strong in me. Of not negatively, like obviously I adore my baby, but of not being in control of my own body or having any sense of agency over it was really weird and unnerving.
The journey of reclaiming that.
That's what I want to write about. Because I think it must be very common and manifests itself in lots of different ways, whether it's sort of sex stuff or exercise stuff or just, you know, getting dressed in the morning stuff. I think I would do that and then leave it. I don't want to be one of those people whose career then just becomes tethered to their position as a mother. I think that's not something I want to do.
Do you have any other plans that you can share with us?
I really want to learn to surf, but I don't know if that's a book or if that will just be a little project like my boxing and ballet.
It's something you'll share on social media, but maybe not in
print.
Yeah,
and I really want to... the only other sort of sport I want to take up is cycling, but that is less to do with wanting to cycle and have a, you know, really expensive bike, but more to do with I've found writing about the sea gave me real a renewed interest in nature. And I think cycling, you can get out to more places and go into the countryside and see more sights and vistas and panoramas and all of that kind of thing.
I love the fact that in all of your descriptions, whether it's running or swimming or cycling, it's not about will I look good in the season's mid-rise jeans. The vocabulary you use and the descriptive terms are all about how the sea looks or feels.
Yeah.
And there's a brilliant thing I heard you say about when it's slightly overcast and it sort of makes the sound echo
bit
when you're
muffled,
in the water.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is lovely, because as you say, if you just focus on your app and, oh, how many miles am I on today, you can miss...
Yeah. I have no desire to be on a 800-pound bike with a heart rate monitor strapped to me, pumping up a hill, trying to feel the burn. But if that's what it will take to be able to do some beautiful cycling in mountains in Spain, then I'll do that bit, because I think that bit will be sublime and enriching and exciting. So we'll see.
I remember listening to a Tim Ferriss podcast, and I forget who the guest was, but he was talking about how I think he would cycle along the beach in LA.
Yeah.
And he would always try and do it in like a particular time.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, and he would always like race. And one day he thought, you know what, today I'm just going to take it easy. I'm going to look at the seagulls. I'm going to look at the water. I'm going to just see what happens. And when he got to the end, he realised he'd shaved like 90 seconds off.
Yeah. And it was, it's really common with running as well. If you leave it at home, you sometimes end up doing better because you're not... I was reading some research in the New York Times yesterday about... They've done some research into people who smile. One of the top marathon runners, I can't remember which one. I'll send you the link. He finished a marathon recently, one of the elite marathons, and kept smiling towards the end. And it was because they've done research recently that people that smile when they're exercising do better. And it's really? That kind of... I mean, for as long as people are doing research like that and I can find to read about it, I'll be exercising because I find that just fascinating.
There's something to do with the jaw as well. I think footballers, when they take penalty kicks, they train to open their mouth at the point they kick the ball. Ooh. So that they're not tense, so it doesn't...
Ooh, yeah, that's
just something to do. Yeah, it really does. Right, on that note, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for not being frightened of the girl who like overshared with you on Twitter a few years ago. It's been a delight. Listeners, I'm going to put all of the show notes, obviously. I'm going to put all of the links to everything that we've discussed, all of your links. I will put the link to your newsletter and to the books that we've mentioned in the show notes that will be on emmaguns.com and iTunes. And thank you so much for listening. Before you go, if you enjoyed that episode of the podcast, I would be so grateful if you could go over to iTunes or wherever it is that you listen and leave a review and rating to say what you enjoyed about the show and why you'll be tuning in again. I hope you'll be joining me for the next episode. Trust me, I have two fantastic guests coming on the show, so I will see you on the next one.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.